You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
.909 here on a Friday. Mike McNamara with you, joined by Battle Buddy Times 3, Michael Musselman. What's up, man?
What's going on?
Nothing. I got an email here. Hey, Mac, I love listening to that Iwo Jima audio. And question, what do you find the most fascinating part of that battle? So I'll ask you first. Mike, what do you find to be the most fascinating part of that battle, which is so unique in American military history, them underground?
I think you asked me this. My answer is that so many of them lived.
Oh, yeah.
You know? I mean, I've been on that island. It's a postage stamp. And we landed that many guys. And that the Japanese survived that naval bombardment. That's another thing. That's just like, I mean, you know, one thing that Marines say to almost to a man about the Japanese in the Pacific was they were no slouches.
Right.
They were good fighters, you know, and they respected them. So, and if you didn't, your days were numbered. But yeah, that whole man, that's just crazy to me.
Yeah, to me,
to land on a beach.
Yeah.
You can't retreat. You can't retreat, man. Your back's to the ocean. You can only go forward. Not like, you know, I'm not saying anything less about the battles of Europe, but you can pull back. You can fall back. You can withdraw. You can flank. You can maneuver. Not on an island, man. Only go straight. Straight is your only option.
And that's crazy. And you know, it's interesting when you listen to the correspondents that are on the island. You know, on D+3, they're not even at the D1 line yet, and they're talking about, well, the hope was today we could hit D3 line, and then, you know, in a couple more days it'll be done. They have over a month to fight, and every day the same. You're just moving the template. You know, naval bombardment, air blast it, you know, blast the crap out of it, and then get after it with infantry guys with satchel charges and trying to find them first and then burn them, blast them, blind them, burn them, and blast
blind
them.
Blind them, three blind V's. Them, burn them, and blast them.
The three V's, man. That was how you took it down, right?
Three V's. Blind, burn, and blast.
Yeah. Yeah, to me the thing that I think, and it has to do a little bit. It's a huge part. It's the, in my opinion, it's the part of battle. And Cal Humphrey said it in the interview that I did with him a couple months ago, and he said, you know, the guy who put that whole thing together was a genius. You know, and the Marine Corps had not encountered they encountered some of it on Saipan. But not like Iwo Jima, where the whole island was a fortress, literally. And, you know, everywhere they went, it was designed to kill Marines in huge numbers before the Japanese died. And they knew they were going to die, which is kind of another unique part of it. How he fortified that island is really an interesting account, and how they knew, you know, they went about the grim task of preparing to die there, and they knew they would, and the way they died, just pretty grim stuff. But that to me is so interesting. And, you know, again, the other, I think, fascinating part is it's the island is untouched with the exception of the airfield that they built on it. And, you know, I would love someday, before I die, to go see it. I never had the opportunity on any of the occasions that I was in the Pacific, to go. And I know, I don't know, how many times, you've been there once or more?
I've been there twice, yeah.
Yeah, see, I know guys.
I was there in 1985. We were like the first U.S. Marines to visit the island. I mean, and like.
And what were you?
I forget how long.
Were you on the Kitty Hawk?
We were on LPH. 11 USS New Orleans, man, on a Mao.
Back
and in... we stopped to do a in Amp, we were going to do an embassy evacuation, like a NEO,
right.
non-combat evacuation of an embassy. And we were using Iwo Jima as the embassy. And I had volunteered to be like a Marine security guard, you know, guy portraying that, you know, at the embassy. So we went ashore like 4 or 5 days before the company, because there's no job for weapons company, at least back then, really, for especially for 81s and that kind of role and mission. So
right.
We were the role players, which was I'm happy with.
Well, no, it got you there. And then what was the second time you went?
And then the second time was we were just another Westpac where we had the opportunity to fly. We landed there. We flew off. We picked up the C-130 the next day and then flew off advance party to another region.
Got it. Yeah, I've never been. I've just I've been kind of a consumer of just reading and every image that I could get my hands on. Every map I could get my hands on, I've taken a look at. You know, who was I talking to? Somebody, Matt Morgan, who produced the Smithsonian special, The Unknown Flag Raiser of Iwo Jima, told me he just was at the, on February 23rd, they did, a thing at the National Museum of the Marine Corps. They talked about the last year in terms of the identification of the re-identification of flag raisers and all the research that went into it, and then they finally think they have the identity of the last person in the gung-ho photo, which is the entire patrol at the top of the hill. They think they've identified him for sure. So we were talking about he said, you know, they're going to display both flags, the first and the second flag, constantly, because putting them up and taking them down is doing more damage to the flags than having them in some kind of permanent display. He said that they also have to change the if you go through the museum, you go into the Iwo Jima kind of thing, you walk in and the door closes behind you, and they said the fire marshal has problems with that, so they're going to have to change that as well. I said, what?
The fire marshal has problems with that.
Yeah, tell him to go to hell, man. You know, that sucks, because it's really cool, because you go in and the door's shut, and you get this briefing over the 1MC, the public address system in the ship, and about Island X and
not
all
the 1MC. Was that the 1MC?
Yeah, it's a 1MC. And so then after you get the briefing, it tells you to report to, wave, one and two, report to your debark stations.
So then
these doors open, and then you walk into this replica of, a landing craft, a Higgins boat, and then the door closes behind you again, and so you're in an enclosed area, and you have video of 360 degrees, and then when you finally hit the beach, the ramp in front of you, the door in front of you opens, and there's the whatever flag they're displaying. You see that as you come out of this thing. So I thought it was cool. I thought it was cool. My kids loved it. They were like, "This is cool."
No, I think it's fantastic, man. The Marine Corps Museum at Quantico is. There's only one other that would come close, and that's the U.S. Infantry Museum at Fort Benning, and that's pretty. I mean, it's almost on the same lines. Where you walk in, there's a cold room, and there's heat. But I think the Marine Corps Museum at Quantico, and I'm not saying this because I'm a Marine, I just say it does a little bit better job. Whereas the Army Museum is a little too big. It's kind of lost. It's still kind of neat, but I think they lose it a little bit as far as the message they're trying to get across.
I've never been. Have you ever been, Mike, to the D-Day? Museum, that one's pretty new, down in New Orleans.
No, I've never been. There's a D-Day museum down there?
Yep. The National D-Day Museum. I remember.
I'm driving, I'm on my way.
How far is that from you?
Oh, it's like a few hours. I mean, a few hours. Once I cross over, to Louisiana, it's a couple hours. But, I mean, I got to drive across basically the width of California times two to get there.
National World War II Museum. National World War II Museum, New Orleans. Nolens.
Yeah, that'd be cool. I'd like to go.
Yeah, they just opened it. I remember because who was Stephen Ambrose was there? He's since passed away, but but it was a big deal. Tom Hanks was a part of it, and it was pretty new. And they're talking about all the different things that are going to. The other thing Matt Morgan told me was that they're going to expand the Iwo Jima portion of the battle. And since they've opened it, they've got more and more stuff, and they're looking for different ways to. To bring, you know, stuff into the museum and find ways to display it. So, you know, stuff Marines have had at home and things like that has evidently after they've seen it, they that's stuff is poured into the Marine Corps. So kind of interesting of the effect of that stuff. So, it looks very cool. It looks an awful lot like the National Museum of the Marine Corps, to be honest with you. I'd be curious to go see that. The email for you. Hey, Mac, good to hear the gunner again. How's he feeling? Mike, update?
Feeling better. I mean, every day. I mean, just still a lot of soreness. I'm not pushing it. I'm not being stupid. I mean, yesterday I walked down the sidewalk a couple times, and I was beat. I was like, oh. You know, I just couldn't believe, you know, like, oh man, but when they take something out of you, it takes it out of you, you know? So I'm just, like we were talking before, I'm just making sure I'm eating right now. I mean, this was a good thing for me. I needed to eat better. I mean, I was eating like crap and I was eating great, somewhere in between, you know?
I think that's most of it. So let me ask you a question: how does your gallbladder have? Is it simply not able to keep up with you know the changes in your body or what? Any idea what causes it?
The gallbladder stores bile,
okay,
for digestive purposes. So you can have a pretty normal, you know. Diet, but I'm starting to eat a lot more steamed vegetables, proteins, good fats, you know,
right.
Avocados, salmon, flax seeds, stuff like that, omega-3 type fats. So, and I'm feeling really good. I mean, and I got to space it out. So I'm doing like four small meals all during the day and like smaller portions. But it's pretty good. You know, I was laughing about it because I was talking to someone about men's breakfast on Saturday. I don't think I will eat anything there. I mean, it's good food, believe me. Sausage, bacon, eggs, hash browns, sausage and gravy,
it's the
biscuits.
Best. That's the thing that had the waffle with the sausage and gravy on it?
Yeah. Well, no, that was Christina.
Oh.
And since then, I've talked to Gary and the owner, and he said, "Hey, just come in and we'll make you something special." So,
all right. Let me tell you. I mean, you and Mike and I were talking about on the air. I had an issue with stress a few years ago, and I was having pain. In my chest, and then I had some in my jaw, and I looked that up, and it says, you know, you're having a heart attack, and so I called the hotline, and the VA hotline as it was, and they said no, go to a hospital, so I went, and they did tests on me for like 3 days, and they actually it was really interesting, they did an ultrasound of my heart, So I go, and they stick this thing on your, the ultrasound thing on your heart, and you're laying there, and you change positions, and you're watching on the TV, and then the girl who's looking at the tape, she's freezing it, and then she's taking measurements of ventricles and openings and timings and stuff like that. So this goes on for almost probably an hour, and she's taking video of my heart. And she looks at me, she goes, "Hey, look, I'm not a doctor. I've just done this for 28 years. And I, she said, "And I'm not supposed to give you an opinion, but there's nothing wrong with your heart." I said, "Oh, really?" She said, "Yeah. You'll need a doctor to give you that opinion. I just look at this every day." She said, "So I don't know what your issues are." And she looked at me, she said, "A lot of times it's stress." I went,
"Right."
"Oh." She said, "So," she said, "good luck." She said, "It's all fixable." She said, "I know it's scary, but," and I'll tell you what, and it was. It's like, you know, what the hell's going on with me, you know? And then you hear this back and forth argument about cholesterol. Is it your cholesterol? Is it not your cholesterol? You know, cholesterol used to be the root evil of all of it, but now you have healthy people that have heart issues based on a family history with regular cholesterol. What is it? And so anyway, so I much of it, in my opinion, was stress, but I didn't help myself at all because of the way I ate. I was a terrible eater. I ate the things that I grew up eating. For instance, breakfast, peanut M&Ms, Pepsi, or Mountain Dew. Let's get after it, boys.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Yeah. On the road, Hostess cupcakes, the chocolate ones, big favorite. Grab a bag.
Debbie snack cake.
grab a bag of potato chips, pop. Let's go. What are we doing? What do we got going? And I've eaten good food my whole life, but you know, it's fast food. And then as you get older, you know, your weight becomes an issue, and if you don't take care of yourself, pretty soon you don't want a PT anymore because you've gotten fat, and that's not a good thing for you. Especially, you know, guys like us that have been active our whole lives. And also one of the downsides about being active your whole life is that you start paying for it as you get older. So you got to learn how to do that too. So it's a little bit of a, I don't know, Mike, how would you say it? It's a little bit of a learning adjustment, as you get older to make sure you do it well.
It's a big learning adjustment, man. Like I said, you're not young anymore, you know? So, I mean, you can't do a lot of that stuff that you did when you were, you know, a lot younger. So. But no, I feel good. I mean, I feel a lot better because the problem I was having before the surgery was any meal I ate, anything, I felt like crap. I mean, I felt like shit afterwards. It would just wear me out. I had no energy, no power to do anything. I was just, it made me feel sick. So then I wouldn't eat. And then, of course, that leads to complications. You know what I mean?
Right. No, but but the golf bladder thing, it's whenever you eat. I mean, it's not functioning right, right? And it just...
Yeah, so when I had food in my stomach, right, when it wasn't functioning, it made me deathly ill. Now that it's gone, when I eat, I actually feel what normal people feel again, and that's energy.
How long has this been going on?
Since, you know, when I was in the Marine Corps.
Really?
And this is that I talked to you about. I mean, this is the Marine Corps and VA diagnosed it as a gastric, you know, a GERD, and gave me pills for it. And not once did they detect these stones. And, you know, I asked the doctor, I said, "These things grow overnight?" And he goes, "No, not in your case. Your case, these stones were probably here 5-6 years. So it's like, you know, you put your faith in something, and then, you know, and then people, then you get the VA guys like, "Well, you know, you should have done this while you're active duty." And I said, "Hey, listen, jackass. You know what? You know what I thought was kind of more important? What was more important was to kind of give it up a little bit and sacrifice and not, because I had a job. People relied on me. I couldn't just be on light duty for, you know, 4 or 5 months out of the year. I had places to go. I had places to be. Again, I had a big responsibility.
I had a job.
I just couldn't shirk it.
I had a job.
Yeah. I just couldn't shirk it. And like I said, go to the sick bay and sit there all day long.
What was I going
to
do? Who does that? Who does that has a
people
job? That has a job. Where people depend
apparently.
On them. Nate, nobody we know, apparently. Right?
No. But apparently, because that's what the VA rewards. Your VA rewards those guys.
Yeah, well, that's yeah. Well, you know what? That's great. That's great. Good for them. Good for them. But that's not the people that we know. It's not the people
nor the people that I want to be associated with,
right.
You know?
Right. Because, you know, when you're there working, you're there to work and people depend on you and you see their courage and selflessness, you're not going to fail. You're not going to fail. You're not going to fail. And I will tell you this. You hear it in Mike when Mike says, I'd go back again. Now, there's no way that Mike physically or mentally ought to go back there. Because everybody can only take so much. Okay? But, right, the spirit is willing. Why?
I would go in a heartbeat.
Because
it would be a long discussion with the wife. She would be pissed. And I don't know if I'd win. But we would have that discussion, and it would go on, and we'd go back and forth. And I don't know if she maybe laid down the ultimatum of this is it. This is if you go, you'll never speak to me again. If that was on the table, I couldn't do it. But I don't think she would do that. I don't know. You know, if I brought it up, oh my God. but Mac, I would go in a heartbeat, man.
Right. Even though it would be
horrible
for you mentally. I read an article.
And physically.
I mean, again.
But I would be in heaven.
It's
to
what.
To be around those guys once again.
Yeah, what you know, it's what
fervent.
You love.
Oh, and you know, Mac, the solemn graces, and I've told people here this, and you got to get out of here, Mac, because you'll see for yourself. But the guys that I associate with myself now, you know, Ralph, Buck, Biff, Ron, Steve, Bob, Mike. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. These are the guys that were there in the hospital, were willing to do anything. People came over, dropped meals off at the house. I mean, these guys are Marines. Now, none of them had ever served in the Marine Corps, but they have the same mentality, same personality. I found my own Marine Corps. I found my group of guys.
Right.
Yeah. And it's an amazing feeling to have that after retirement. Because they say, you know, you never miss an institution. You miss the company.
Right.
And I do. And I miss the company all day long. I look back and some of my most cherishable moments are, you know, like I said, goofy stuff in meetings and formations, throwing stuff at each other, getting each other in trouble, like little kids.
Right.
But then stepping up when it comes serious and making calls that have people's lives in the line.
With those same guys, knowing that they have your back
with
no matter what.
Guys.
Yeah.
And
you hear, I mean, you hear a bit of it when we do our jackassery with Montana Man and Rudy hopped on the other day with that group. It's those guys. And you know, here's the truth. They would die before they would let you down. And you would do the same.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Without a question.
But like I said, I found them here in Grand Bay.
Yeah. No,
and
that's
a marvelous feeling.
No, it's and again, it's what you're right, Mike. It's the things that you never ever get over. Hey, I want to read you something. We were talking about casualty notification, and this might take me a few minutes, but do you mind if I read a little bit of an article written by a lieutenant colonel by the name of George Goodson?
Yeah, go ahead.
He wrote it when he was 76 years old. and it's entitled Burial at Sea. It was published in the Marine Corps Gazette in 2007. In my 76th year, the events of my life appear to me from time to time as a series of vignettes. Some were significant, most were trivial. War is the seminal event in the life of everyone who has endured it. Though I fought in Korea and the Dominican Republic and was wounded there, Vietnam was my war. Now 37 years have passed, and thankfully I rarely think of those days in Cambodia, Laos, and the panhandle of North Vietnam, where small teams of Americans and Montagnards fought such larger elements of the NVA. Instead, I see vignettes, some exotic, some mundane. And he talks about the smells and things like that. It was late in 1967. I just returned from 18 months in Vietnam. Casualties were increasing. I moved my family from Indianapolis to Norfolk, rented a house, enrolled my children in their fifth and sixth new school, and bought a second car. A week later, I put on my uniform, drove 10 miles to Little Creek, Virginia. I hesitated before entering my new office. Appearances important to a career Marine. I was no longer, if ever, a poster Marine. I had returned from my third tour in Vietnam only 30 days before. I am 5'9". I weighed 128 pounds, 37 pounds below my normal weight. My uniform fit ludicrously. My skin was yellow from malaria, and I had a twitch or two. I straightened my shoulders, walked into an office, and looked at the nameplate on a staff sergeant's desk, Sergeant Jolly. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Goodson. Here are my orders and my OQR. Jolly stood, looked at me carefully, took my orders, stuck out his hand. We shook hands. How long were you there, Colonel? I replied, 18 months this time. Jolly breathed, Jesus, you must be a slow learner, and smiled. He then said, Colonel, I'll show you your office and bring the sergeant major. No, let's just go straight to the office. Jolly hesitated and lowered his voice. Colonel, the sergeant major, he's been in his job for two goddamn years. He's packed pretty tight. I'm worried about him. Jolly escorted me into the sergeant major's office. Sergeant major, this is Colonel Goodson, the new commanding officer. Sergeant major stood, extended his hand, and said, good to see you again, Colonel. I responded, hello, Walt. How are you? Jolly looked at me, raised an eyebrow, walked out, and closed the door. I sat down with the sergeant major. He had the obligatory cup of coffee and talked about mutual acquaintances. Walt's stress was palpable. Finally, I said, Walt, what the hell's wrong? He turned in his chair, looked out the window, and said, George, you're going to wish you were back in Nam before you leave here. I've been in the Marine Corps since 1939. I was in the Pacific 36 months, Korea for 14 months, and Vietnam for 12. Now I come here to bury these kids. I'm putting my letter in. I can't take it anymore. I said, okay, Walt, if that's what you want, I'll endorse your request for retirement and do what I can to push it through Headquarters Marine Corps. Sergeant Major Walt X retired 12 weeks later. He had been a good Marine for 28 years, but he had seen too much death, too much suffering. He was used up. Over the next 16 months, I made 28 death notifications, conducted 28 military funerals, and made 30 notifications to families of Marines that were severely wounded or missing in action. Most of the details of those casualty notifications have now, thankfully, faded from my memory. Four, however, remain. The first notification, my third or fourth day in Norfolk, was notified of the death of a 19-year-old Marine. His notification came by telephone from Headquarters Marine Corps, the information detailed. The boy's family lived over the border in North Carolina, about 60 miles away. I drove there in a Marine Corps staff car, crossing the state line into North Carolina. I stopped at a small country store, service station, post office. I went to ask directions. Three people were in the store. A man and woman approached the small post office window. The man held a package. The store owner walked up and addressed them by name. Hello, John. Good morning, Mrs. Cooper. I was stunned. My casualty's next of kin's name was John Cooper. I hesitated, then stepped forward and said, I beg your pardon. Are you Mr. and Mrs. John Cooper of, and he gave the address. The father looked at me. I was in uniform and then shaking, bent at the waist, vomited. His wife looked horrified at him and then at me. Understanding came into her eyes and she collapsed in slow motion. I think I caught her before she hit the floor. The owner took a bottle of whiskey out of the drawer and handed it to Mr. Cooper, who drank. I answered their questions for a few minutes, then I drove them home in my staff car. The store owner locked the store and followed in his truck. We stayed an hour or so until the family began to arrive. I returned the store owner to his business. He thanked me and said, "Mister, I wouldn't have your job for $1 million. I shook his hand and said, "Neither would I. I vaguely remember the drive back to Norfolk, violating about 5 Marine Corps regulations. I drove this staff car straight to my house. I sat with my family while they ate dinner, went into the den, closed the door, and sat there all night alone. My Marines steered clear of me for days. I had made my first death notification. Funerals, weeks passed, more notifications, more funerals. I borrowed Marines from local Marine reserves and taught them to conduct military. I borrowed Marines, taught them to conduct military funerals, how to carry a casket, how to fire the volleys, how to fold a flag. When I presented the flag to the mother, wife, or father, I always said, "All Marines share in your grief." I had been instructed to say on behalf of a grateful nation, da 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 da. I didn't think the nation was grateful, so I didn't say that. Sometimes my emotions got the best of me, and I couldn't speak. When that happens, I would just hand the flag and touch a shoulder. They would look at me and nod. Once a mother said to me, quote, "I'm so sorry you have this terrible job." My eyes filled with tears, and I leaned over and kissed her. Another notification, six weeks after my first, I had another. This was a young PFC. I drove to his mother's house. As always, I was in uniform and driving a Marine Corps staff car. I parked in front of the house, took a deep breath, walked towards the house. Suddenly, the door flew open. A middle-aged woman rushed out. She looked at me and ran across the yard screaming, "No, no, 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 no." I hesitated. Neighbors came out. I ran to her, grabbed her, and whispered stupid things to reassure her. She collapsed. I picked her up and carried her into the house. 8 or 9 neighbors followed. 10 or 15 minutes later, the father came home, followed by an ambulance personnel. I have no recollection of leaving. The funeral took place about 2 weeks later. We went through the drill. The mother never looked at me. The father looked at me once and shook his head sadly. Another notification. One morning, as I sat in the office, the phone was ringing. Sergeant Jolly held the phone up and said, "You've got another one, Colonel." I nodded, walked into my office, picked the phone, took the notes, thanked the officer for making the call. I have no idea why, and hung up. Jolly, who had listened, came in with a special telephone directory that translated phone numbers into the person's address and place of employment. The father of this casualty was a longshoreman. He lived a mile from my office. I called the longshoreman's union office and asked for the business manager. He answered the phone. I told him who I was and asked for the father's schedule. The business manager said, "Is it his son?" I said nothing. After a moment, he said in a low voice, "Tom is at home today." I said, "Don't call him. I'll take care of that." The business manager said, "Aye, aye, sir," and then explained, "Tom and I were Marines in World War II. I got in my staff car and drove to the house. I was in uniform. I knocked, and the woman in her early 40s answered the door. I saw instantly that she was clueless. I said, "Is Mr. Smith home?" She smiled pleasantly and responded, "Yes, but he's eating breakfast now. Can you come back later?" I said, "I'm sorry. It's important. I need to see him now." Then she nodded, stepped back into the beach house and said, "Tom, it's for you." A moment later, a ruddy man in his late 40s appeared at the door. He looked at me, turned absolutely pale, steadied himself and said, "Jesus Christ, man, he's only been there 3 weeks. Months passed, more notifications of funerals. Then one day I was running. Sergeant Jolly stepped outside the building and gave a loud whistle, 2 fingers in his mouth. I could never do that, and held an imaginary phone to his ear. Another call from headquarters, Marine Corps. I took notes, got it, hung up. I had stopped saying thank you long ago. Jolly said, "Where?" "Eastern Shore of Maryland. The father is retired chief petty officer. His brother will accompany the body back from Vietnam." Jolly shook his head, slowly straightened, and then said, "This time of day, it'll take 3 hours to get there and back. I'll call the Naval Air Station, borrow a helicopter, and I'll have Captain Tolliver get one of his men to meet you and drive you to the chief's home." He did. 4 minutes later, I was knocking on the father's door. He opened the door, looked at me, and looked at the Marine standing at parade rest beside the car and asked, "Which one of my boys is it, Colonel?" I stayed a couple of hours, gave him my information, my office, and home phone number, and told him to call anytime. He called me that evening at 2300. I've gone through my boy's papers and found a will. He has to be buried at sea. Can you make that happen? I said, yes, I can, Chief. I can and I will. My wife and I, my wife had been listening and said, can you do that? I told her, I have no idea, but I'm going to break my ass trying. I called Lieutenant General Alpha Bowser, Commanding General Fleet Marine Force Atlantic, at home at 2330, explained the situation and asked, General, can you get me a quick appointment with the Admiral at Atlantic Fleet Headquarters? General Bowser said, George, you come here tomorrow at 9 o'clock. He'll see you. I was, and the Admiral did. He said coldly, how can the Navy help the Marine Corps, Colonel? I told him the story, turned to the Chief of Staff. He turned to his Chief of Staff and said, which is the sharpest destroyer in port? The Chief of Staff responded with a name. The Admiral called the ship. Captain, you're going to do the burial at sea. You'll report to a Marine Lieutenant Colonel Goodson until this mission is complete. He hung up, looked at me, and said, next time you need a ship, Colonel, call me. You don't have to sick Bowser on my ass. Aye, sir, I responded and got the hell out of his office. I went to the ship, met with the captain, XO, and the senior chief. Sergeant Jolly and I trained the ship's crew for 4 days. Then Jolly raised a question none of them had thought about. These government caskets are airtight. How do we keep it from floating? All the high-priced help, including me, sat there looking dumb. Then the senior chief stood and said, come on, Jolly, I know a bar where there's retired guys from World War II who hang out. They returned a couple of hours later, slightly worse for the wear, and said, it's simple. We cut 4 12-inch holes in the outer shell of the casket. On each side, insert 300 pounds of lead in the foot of the casket, and we can handle that, no sweat. The day arrived, the ship and the sailors looked razor sharp. General Bowser, the Admiral, a U.S. Senator, and a Navy band were on board. The sealed casket was brought aboard, taken below for modification. The ship got underway to the 12-fathom depth. The sun was hot, the ocean flat, the casket brought aft and placed on a platform. The chaplain spoke, the volleys were fired, the flag was removed, folded, and I gave it to the father. The band played Eternal Father, Strong to Save. The casket was raised slightly to the head and slid into the sea. The heavy casket plunged straight down about 6 feet, the water colliding with the air pockets on the outer shell. The casket stopped abruptly, rose straight to the top of the water, about 3 feet, stopped, and slowly slipped back into the sea. The air bubbles rising from the sinking casket sparkled in the sunlight as the casket disappeared from sight forever. The next morning, I called a personal friend, Lieutenant General Oscar Petros, at Headquarters Marine Corps, and said, General, get me the fuck out of here. I can't take this shit anymore. I was transferred 2 weeks later. I was a good Marine, but after 17 years, I had seen too much death and too much suffering. I was used up. Vacating my house, my family, and I drove to the office in a two-car convoy. I said my goodbyes. Sergeant Jolly walked out with me, waved to my family, looked at me with tears in his eyes, came to attention, saluted, and said, well done, Colonel, well done. I felt as if I had received the Medal of Honor. That is all. And the article is entitled Burial at Sea, and it came about when Mike and I were talking yesterday about the casualty notification process. And so I did kind of a search, and it's hard to find information. I didn't find an article that talked about historically when we started doing these kind of notifications, because we were talking about, you know, the telegram system in World War II and all of that. And then I ran across this story, and it was like, holy shit, man, holy shit. It's like, and I read it and I thought, you know, and I don't know if I should read this, but I remember when I had, Tim Lynch's uncle on, his name's Chuck Lynch. He got out as a lieutenant colonel. He told me he had done over 100 of these in upstate New York, while he was on recruiting duty. And, and then he said he did essentially the same thing. He called his monitor. He said, you need to get me the hell out of here. And the monitor said, look, the only thing I have open is Vietnam. And he said, I'll take it. And so you hear these stories, and, man, they're just ass kickers, you know. And to me, the parts of them that are they're the hardest even to read are when the guy's saying he's only been there 3 weeks because it's not, you know, it's so personal. You know, can you bury him at sea? And again, the coolest part of the guys that we work with is is they would all do the same thing that lieutenant colonel did. Yes, we'll bury him at sea. And then your wife's saying, can you do that? Like, I don't know if I can, but I'll tell you what, we're going to find a way to do it. Because the guys we work with are those kind of guys. But anyway, I thought it was just a very cool story. The lieutenant colonel who wrote it passed away a couple years ago. His name is Lieutenant Colonel George Goodson, USMC retired. But I thought it was a pretty cool article about what a brutal task that is. What a solemn responsibility it is. But it's just an ass kicker. So anyway.
The movie that Taking Chance,
right?
The Taking, and that's a very moving movie. Where here's a young officer who hadn't been over there yet, felt it was his duty, and then he goes through and basically writes a diary of what happened.
This is a small world part of that story. That happened when Mike and I were in Iraq. It was General Kelly's personal security detachment, and I kind of oversaw both he and General Mattis's personal security detachments, and made sure that they had all the things they need, and they had their jobs every day, but they worked out of they worked for the chief of staff, and as did I, so I wound up dealing with them all the time. The guy who ran that was a first lieutenant by the name of Dan Robertson, and just a great kid, and so he ran General Kelly around. They were Artie guys, actually. I want to say from either 211 or 311. And I remember when Chance Phelps was killed. They got ambushed down Route San Juan, Route Iron
Something like that. Yep.
They were headed for this place called Escanderia Mamadia. It was out in the desert away, and it was kind of a bad place that we didn't go very often. Anyway, they were out there and they got ambushed, and Robertson got wounded in the ambush. Phelps was killed. And I remember when he got a letter he got a letter before he left saying that that this colonel who had escorted the body had written this article that appeared in, I want to say it appeared in the Chicago Tribune or something like that. And then it became this, this national story about this lieutenant colonel's experience escorting this body from Dover. He thought it was going to Colorado, and it wound up going to Montana, was it, Mike? I think it wound up going to Montana.
I think it was Montana.
Yeah, and the experience he has of escorting the remains from Dover, which they, as Mike said, they made into a movie, and so an HBO movie. If you've never seen it, but again, I mean, small world. That it happens. And I remember when Dan wrote me a letter and said, "Hey, sir, they're gonna make it a movie. That article, they're gonna turn into a movie." I was like, "Wow, holy shit!" But anyway, it's just I don't know how we got talking about that the other day. But in World War II, you got a telegram, and that was it. And obviously we've come a lot further from that. What do you, any plans for the weekend? Just going to lay low and take it easy?
Planning right now to take the wife shooting.
Oh, really?
Yeah, take her out Saturday, go shooting.
Somebody sent me an email. I got talking on my other show, North Dakota show, the subject of ammunition came up. Do you do your own ammunition, Mike?
No, I used to. I'm going to probably start again. I used to load my own, but I don't anymore now.
I'm
going to, though.
Yeah. Really? What's the upside of loading your own ammunition?
It's fun. I mean, it is. It's a lot of fun, man. But you know what you're loading, so you're loading, the right load every time, and it's actually cheaper. I mean, it's a good cost going in, but in the long run, it's cheaper if you shoot a lot. So,
email, text message. Jesus, you two are depressing the last 2 days. we can't always be funny. Another email, an email says this. Hey, Mac, I thought burials at sea, at least the ones I recall seeing from newsreel footage, primarily from World War II, the bodies are encased in canvas bags with weights in the canvas bags. They're under flags. There was normally multiple bodies on a board, and the all covered in flags, and the board was raised, it looked like from the rail, vertically, and then all the bodies, the white body bags, it looks like canvas type, slid into the ocean and then disappeared. I've never heard of I've never heard of the casket version of that. Nor
well,
had I.
What he's referring to is in World War II when they died in service on the ship, and then they buried him at sea while they were still at war.
Had you ever heard of the casket thing?
No. Well, yes, because I did one when I was a Mardette on an aircraft carrier.
You did? You did it?
Yeah.
And it was a full, I mean, I've scattered ashes at sea as part of the Mardette. That's not something you really want to be a part of, but because of the wind.
No, we did a.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, we did a full-blown casket at sea.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's, wow. Yeah, I mean, reading that article was the first time I'd ever heard of a casket at sea. I thought if you were buried at sea, I thought it was in by naval regulations in the canvas bag, in a weighted canvas bag. Who knew? Yeah, no, I was we scattered, and it was one of the, you know, so in when you're on a Mardette, you're part of weapons, the weapons department of the ship. And the gun boss is the head guy, and you're a piece of that. One of the senior chiefs in the weapons department, his dad passed away. He's a World War II Navy guy, and he wanted his ashes scattered at sea. And so we did that. And so that was my experience with burials at sea. And the hardest part of that was getting the ship pointed in the right direction, right, so that when you did, you know, scatter the ashes, that, you know, they went the right direction, and that took us forever. It took us like 2 hours to do that. And you know how, Mike, the wind, you know, depending on which hangar bay doors are open, and, you know, the wind whips around the ship and, you know, around the sponsons that you're out on, you know, you're just sitting there going, please, God, don't turn this into a fiasco, you know. But it's not like somebody gave us somebody's ashes and isn't there. His son is standing right here with us. And so, So yeah, it was very solemn, you know, very obviously a solemn occasion, but the Marines were really happy to do it because, you know, a lot of times Marines participate in things where they don't know anybody, and this was the first time that obviously there was some connection, and they knew the senior chief in weapons department, and they respected him and liked him, and so they were more than happy to do it. So, what's the most unique ceremonial thing you ever did?
The most unique. I did a Princess Diana when she
what?
And you know, I was part of that group.
What did you do? What did you do?
I just part of just meeting her.
I mean, you like you shook her hand and got to say, "Hey, what's up?"
Yeah. Yep.
Really?
Yeah.
She good looking
beautiful,
girl?
Beautiful, classy woman.
Really?
Oh my God. She was as like, you know, from the golden age of film, you know, just that rare beauty and class. Yeah.
And so is this while you were stationed in England?
Yeah.
Wow. Wow, Mike, that makes you kind of a celebrity. Who knew?
Yeah, I mean, you know, people have met her, but I mean, yeah, it was kind of a neat experience.
Hello, Princess Diana. Boom. Yeah, I was always a huge fan of hers. I thought she was. She seemed like a normal, like real as normal as like that kind of world can be. But she seemed down to earth, and she, you know, I remember hearing a story where she was at the White House, and I don't know, for some kind of dinner. And they said, is there anything you want to do? She said, well, John Travolta is going to be here, yes? And they said, yeah. She said, I'd love to dance with him. And I saw him get interviewed and talk about it. And he said, yeah, they asked him. They said, yeah, you know, she's a tall girl. And, you know, she said, and he said, you know, she wanted to lead a little bit. So I had to like rein her in. And, he said, but you know, it was a wonderful night at the White House. And, she obviously, she's a fan of Grease. So, they teed up a little Grease music and we danced. He said it was pretty cool. But, wow, Mike, who knew? You're royalty. Interesting.
Yeah, close, right?
All right. What are you, going to shoot, just do some pistol shooting?
Yeah, do some pistol shooting with the wife tomorrow.
All right.
Looking forward to it, yeah.
One more email, I'll let you go. Hey, Mac, I'm curious, when Gunner does his own loads, you guys were talking about reduced load ammunition for women. Does he do any of that, or does he load it full load, just his stuff? Mike?
Sometimes I'll buy a 9mm, 147 subsonic 9mm ammo.
Right.
And it's a reduced load, but, you know, anything like that. But yeah, if you load it, you can really control then how much powder you put in there. And then that's also a good idea. But anything you buy subsonic, for a handgun for a girl is a win-win.
Got it.
Getting easier shooting, yeah.
Okay. All right. All right, man. Good luck shooting.
All right, man. I'll see you next week.
All right. There you have it. All right. Thanks. I hope you feel better. That is Battle Buddy Times 3, the Gunner. Another email. Mac, what was the title of that article? It's called Burial at Sea. I'll put it up on... I'll put it up on the All Marine Radio Facebook page. And I'll put it up on the show notes page of All Marine Radio. So, yeah. Yeah, and again, I was researching the whole casualty, you know. When did that happen? I don't recall any, Korean War. I don't have any recollection of seeing... or reading casualty, so maybe we still sent telegrams in Korea. Vietnam is the first time I remember seeing these kind of stories. So, anyway, my thanks to you for listening today. Salmon on a Plank, give it a try. Re-listen to the first hour, and Kim has great strategy for salmon. You got to soak the plank for an hour. Don't forget to do that. And then he tells you how to heat the plank and then lay the salmon on it and do all that good stuff and to get that nice cedar taste in salmon. Who knew? All right, have a great weekend. On Friday, All Marine Radio. Out.